This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Here is how worried scientists are about tipping points. 160 scientists from 23 countries just released the Global Tipping Points Report 2025. No one, not experts at COP30 in Brazil, not insurance companies, not governments, no one imagines the big climate shifts already in motion. Dr. Stephen Smith, research fellow at Global Systems Institute, talks us through planetary scale risks. Then provocative Swedish intellectual and professor Andreas Malm on his new book, The Long Heat. Surprise, surprise, geoengineering will not save us from climate catastrophe. Think it through. Answers from the Edge, it's Radio EcoShock. We all have our breaking points. So do natural systems. From the sea currents that warm the UK and North Europe to the Amazon rainforest, things may head into a decline with no recovery, and maybe faster than expected. Media call them tipping points, scientists now call them tipping elements. The first Global Tipping Points report was launched December 2023 for COP28 in Dubai. The second report just came out ahead of the COP30 in Brazil. And this is a big study, and it has worrying news about disastrous changes, possibly, on a planetary scale. And there are ways to reduce the risk. Here to explain is Dr. Stephen R. Smith, research fellow at the Global Systems Institute, University of Exeter, and he's also with University of Surrey. He specializes in green future solutions. From the UK, Stephen Smith, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
From the public to politicians, why do you think there is so much interest in tipping points?
Well, there's a lot of interest, Alex, in tipping points because, well, both the good and the bad ones, because these are the major risks of escalating change, either damaging change or positive change. So normally when we think of change, change happens slowly, and as the old saying goes, until it happens all at once. And so tipping points are when change starts happening all at once, and therefore it's extremely worrying when the risk of that major changes could happen very abruptly and irreversibly. But also there are great opportunities for accelerating solutions as well. So the interest is in the self-propelling sort of accelerating change.
And the big one in Europe is really about the Gulf Stream, technically called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC. What is at stake for Europe and Scandinavia if this big current loses power?
Yes, as you say, the Gulf Stream is a part of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. It's sort of like the central heating system for Northern Europe. Because here in the UK, for example, we are on the sort of similar latitude to Halifax, Nova Scotia. And so it's quite far north. But thanks to the AMOC, we are actually living in quite a nice sort of temperate, warm area. And that's because the AMOC brings up about 60 times the amount of heat that the whole of humanity produces every year. It's an enormous amount of energy. An enormous amount of warmth that is brought up using that convection current from the tropics up towards the poles. So it's a lifeline for Northern Europe, and when occasionally a part of the AMOC shuts down, which happened in the Middle Ages, we call it the Little Ice Age, then there can be an fairly abrupt change that happens over a couple of decades, and when that system of shuts down or slows down, it could make a serious difference to the average temperature of Northwest Europe, but also will affect for example, the eastern seaboard of the United States, because it will also cause sea levels to rise.
Do we have ideas about how fast the AMOC current could collapse? Are we talking about 50 years where winters get colder a bit every year in Northern Europe, or could it be faster than that even?
According to evidence from history, it could happen within a couple of decades. So that's pretty abrupt in terms of and the actual difference in temperature if there's a full AMOC shutdown, which I have to say is considered still unlikely within this century. But unlikely means in scientific terms, means, you know, it could be as little as sort of a 10% chance this century. But you certainly wouldn't get on a plane if there was a 10% chance of it, you know, sort of crashing. So even unlikely things are things that we would do an awful lot to try to avoid. And the difference in temperatures might be as much as sort of 10 degrees Celsius. If it did fully shut down over the course of a couple of decades, it would be a major problem, because, of course, infrastructure is not equipped to cope with that kind of a temperature difference. There could be a major disruption, obviously, to agriculture, to the ability to grow food. There are certain modelling that has been done that says that there could be as much as 3 months of ice in London, and ice sheets as far down as halfway down the North Sea. So it would be a huge major change to the climate of Northern Europe. But it would also affect, the AMOC is in the Atlantic Ocean, but it could also affect the monsoons in Africa and India as well. It's a kind of the AMOC is one of those things that connects to many other systems, including even the Amazon rainforest and both the Arctic and the Antarctic poles and ice sheets. So,
yes, the report talks about cascading tipping points. What kinds of feedback loops are scientists most worried about?
Well, of course, we're most concerned with the kind of first-order effects of tipping points, but what cascading tipping points mean is that one tipping point can lead to another and to another, and not only within the Earth system, but the cascading impacts follow on just from those first-order impacts to affecting human systems, society, social cohesion, political stability, food, famine, financial impacts, you know. So it cascades across all sectors of human society, as well as just affecting the immediate sort of physical infrastructures and assets.
Well, we're going to get to ways that might actually help us when it comes to human affairs. But first, I'd like to cover a little bit more about nature. Scientists have identified another 15 tipping elements so far. And one of those lines of irreversibility may have already been crossed for warm water coral. Why is one species included with other big system changes like ocean currents? And what does the report say about coral tipping?
Since our last report in 2023, we have, in those 2 years, we've witnessed over a year now of temperatures greater than 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average. And the long-term average is already around 1.4 degrees Celsius. So overshooting the agreed 1.5 degrees limit that was set years ago at the Paris Agreement now looks fairly inevitable, and it could happen as early as 2030. What this means is that it puts us into sort of a new danger zone of escalating risk. It's not inevitable that tipping points will happen once we go above a 1.5 degrees Celsius. It just increases the risk for every increment above that point. I'm sure we've all noticed the unprecedented extreme weather events, from storms and floods and heat waves and wildfires and droughts and so on, including the Amazon rainforest's worst ever drought last year. What we're recording, all of these changes, all of these extreme weather events and unprecedented changes. The canary in the coal mine, or the most sensitive ecosystem of them all, really, is the coral reefs. So marine heat waves are obviously periods of unusual warmth in the oceans. They have hit 80% of the world's warm water coral reefs, including the worst coral bleaching event on record, which is still ongoing. And the response of the coral reefs confirms that we can no longer think about tipping points as a future risk, because widespread dieback of warm water coral reefs is really currently underway, and it will be impacting many people who depend on reefs for fishing and tourism and coastal protection in the years to come. So the report that we've just launched provides a very detailed case study on the coral reef tipping point, which is the first of a series of tipping points that we risk as we head into the overshoot of 1.5 degrees Celsius. It doesn't mean that we should give up on the idea of having any coral reefs. It's just a process that's now beginning to be underway once the temperature overheat has exceeded the thermal tipping point of corals. And unless we stop and decarbonize our atmosphere as quickly as possible by stopping emissions and work as quickly as we can to start reducing the global temperature, the greater chance that we have of saving as much of the coral reefs as possible. So there is still hope, and there is still a lot to work for. So we must try our best to decarbonize as quickly as possible.
And ahead of COP30, your new report suggests human society may also have tipping elements that could work in our favor as we try to save the livable climate. Could you give us an example, Steve?
Yeah, certainly. So we normally associate these tipping points with the harmful ones that we've just been talking about in the ice sheets and the AMOC and the Amazon and the corals. But there are also positive, what we call positive tipping points, in both in nature and in human systems. And they work using a similar concept of self-propelling change beyond a threshold. So, for example, since the last report, since 2023, we've witnessed rapid exponential progress in the uptake of clean technologies worldwide, especially in solar power and wind power and electric vehicles. So solar power is growing exponentially, doubling in capacity about every 2 years now. So there is a solar energy revolution underway, and it's already actually in almost every part of the world the cheapest form of electricity generation. That's one of the great positive tipping points that's happening at the moment. And, well, we have the first opportunity now to provide universal, cheap, clean electricity for everybody, especially in places that didn't already have electricity. So we're talking about access to electricity for the whole planet.
And I believe that was Nikola Tesla's dream, was to provide electricity for everyone. Do you see ways to stimulate positive tipping elements in society, or at least to provide fertile ground for large-scale changes that we really need?
Yeah, I mean, this is why the governance, the collective effort that we need is just as important with the positive tipping points to promote them as it is to use governance to prevent the negative tipping points from happening. So just still on the subject of the positive tipping points that we want, we have an opportunity to work together, and some of the most effective ways that we can work together is we have found evidence that using mandates to ban the future sale of fossil fuel cars, for example, or fossil fuel boilers, mandates are generally the most effective policies to trigger these positive tipping points in the energy system or in mobility, in cars and trucks and so on, towards the clean technologies and transition away from fossil fuels. However, in order for that to work, you first got to have the alternative in place. So this is why the sequence of policies is so important, that we need to promote the innovations that we want by investing in them and helping to support the growth of these innovations using investment and by providing the infrastructure. For example, you know, being able to put in the charging stations for the electric vehicles and so on, so that alternative can be, for all of us, not only the most affordable option, but also the most accessible and the most convenient.
And while this report has a chapter on positive social tipping points, you do not discount negative social tipping points either. Is that when things go rapidly wrong? What is a negative social tipping element, Steve?
Yeah, so as you say, Alex, tipping points can be both positive and negative, and they can happen both in the natural and the human sort of social world. So negative social tipping points would be where you have a breakdown in society, for example, when a country becomes highly politically polarized and can collapse into civil war, for example, or there is a breakdown in social cohesion and social trust, or indeed in the economic sphere, there is a risk of a shock to the economic system. And that's a risk not only associated with the risk of these Earth system tipping points breaking down, where you have a potential shock to the economic and financial system. But also, if you try to change too fast, there is always a risk of instability. And, for example, with stranded assets, if we are not careful, we could get to a situation where by making these fossil fuel assets worthless, they can become stranded assets and it could destabilize the whole financial system. So it's really important to manage the transition very carefully and with due consideration to these tipping points, setting off what we call unintended consequences.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Global Tipping Points 2025. Alex talks with Exeter scientist Stephen Smith.
The new Tipping Points report talks about finance to save the climate. Almost every major bank and investment company is financing profitable fossil fuels with trillions of dollars or euros and renewables hardly at all. Is it naive to think financial institutions will act to save species and the climate if it costs them profits?
Yeah, it's a great question. We've seen recently some fairly disappointing news that a lot of the major banks have withdrawn their support for the initiatives that were launched at previous COPs. For example, the Glasgow COP, when they launched the net greening of the financial system. And also recently, there's been a report that every major bank is still financing new coal, oil, and gas fields. So there's a lot to be disappointed and worried about there. But at the same time, I don't think it's naive to think that we could come together to change and to really make a tipping point towards a new way of financing the transition. I think this COP in Belém in Brazil is going to be hugely important for finance, because at the last COP, you may remember, there was a new initiative called the Baku to Belém roadmap, whereby nations of the world agreed to enter into a financial facility worth $1.3 trillion a year, which was a major, by 2035, which was a major advance on the previous sort of financing facility. So I think there's going to be, well, we hope there's going to be some major advances in that direction in this COP. There is certainly a lot of goodwill there, but as you say, at the end of the day, these financial companies, they have a responsibility to their shareholders and so on as well. So it takes a lot of public pressure, for example, to then give the legitimacy to our world leaders to take action to curb the behaviors of the financial operators and try to create a more positive financial environment, not only for investing in these new technologies, but also lowering the cost of capital to enable the emerging markets and the emerging countries in Africa and Asia and the majority world to afford the transition themselves.
Yes, the new report has a section on the human rights aspects of tipping points. It says Earth system tipping points are a human rights issue. Now, as we know, the struggle for rights and justice is losing ground in some countries, possibly even in the UK. Is adding human rights an unnecessary distraction to the central problem of extreme climate change?
For me, human rights are inextricably linked to the whole tipping points agenda. Obviously, there are huge implications, especially for the majority world, because it's the most vulnerable nations who are least responsible for this mess we're in as far as the climate and nature crisis goes, who are suffering the most. And at the same time, the interventions that we are undertaking to try to rectify the situation, whether it's solar panels or electric vehicles or heat pumps in our homes and so on, they often require raw materials that are sourced in the majority world, and there are human rights implications in the extraction and production of these new technologies. So we can't separate the very necessary effort that we have to transform our world as rapidly as we can, but in our haste to engineer sustainable and post-fossil fuel economy, we also have to remember that there are winners and losers. It's incumbent upon us to create the world that we want to see. That includes a fairer world and a juster world, as well as a climate-stable world.
There is a new climate movement now spreading from Brazil. It's called a global mutirao. What is that?
Yes, the global mutirao is a particularly Portuguese-Brazilian concept, which means, it doesn't just mean collaboration or cooperation, but it means coming together. It's a coming together of people to create something new. And so it is a call to action that, for the first time ever, this is the first COP whereby each COP has its own sort of culturally significant concepts that it uses to promote the COP and to help the success of the COP. And this particular COP in Brazil is trying to engage not just the diplomats in their enclosed blue zone, but also the wider civil society in the green zone and beyond throughout the world to create the global mutual, which means it means many different things to many people. And the effort is not to try and define it too tightly that would exclude some people, but to keep it as inclusive and open as possible. And there are dozens of different ways that people are using the concept to create their own, you know, localized and place-based or particular kind of change, whether it's the Global Citizens Assembly, where people come together and participate in helping to co-create the future they want through participatory sort of democratic engagement, or whether it's encouraging various local cooperative energy cooperatives to come together and to accelerate the energy transition in their own local place. There are loads of different examples of how the global mutual is going to be unfolding in this COP, including, I heard today, a wonderful way to try to bring together sports and the arts and all kinds of human endeavor.
Given the upcoming UN summit on the future and COP30, what outcomes would signal the world is taking tipping points seriously?
Well, that's a great question. There's a couple of things that are really important here. Tipping points are still not, despite their huge risk, they're still not included in the way that financial organizations, insurance companies, or governments, how they assess risk. So one really, really positive outcome would be if all financial institutions, insurance companies, and government departments could integrate tipping points into their risk assessments, so that they can include the risk of tipping points in all of their sort of planning, really. The second thing would be for the nations of the world to really use the Global Tipping Points report to accelerate their level of ambition to halve emissions by 2030. That would be the ideal ambition, and to generally accelerate the decarbonization effort as quickly as possible, because we need to keep fossil fuels in the ground and to transition as rapidly as possible to a post-fossil fuel economy, which is going to be a win-win for everybody, provided that, as I say, that it could be managed carefully so that the people currently employed in the fossil fuel industry can be protected, and to gradually over the course of several decades to be reskilled and found alternative kinds of employment and skills.
From Green Future Solutions and Global Systems Institute, University of Exeter, we've been speaking with Dr. Stephen R. Smith. Find the Global Tipping Points Report 2025 at globaltippingpoints.org. Steve, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Alex, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Good. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
2 decades ago, a handful of scientists concerned themselves with tipping points, but it was a sideline. The 2004 movie The Day After Tomorrow brought the North Atlantic collapse to the public, but sped up for entertainment. Even a few years ago, I could name the specialists working on tipping points. We had a few of the new young scientists on, like Johannes Lohmann and Levka Caesar. In the UK, Tim Lenton of Exeter has been a driver in the field, and Stefan Rahmstorf in Germany became more and more the spokesperson, alarmed for the future of Europe. But this 2025 report has 160 scientific contributors from 23 countries. This is an emergency movement of science. They have seen large icebergs out ahead of us on the Titanic. Will the captains of industry and big money pools keep ordering full speed ahead on fossil fuels? I have a confession. For every guest, I read all the papers or the book and dig up more. When I got this massive global tipping points report, there was no way. I would need a week or two off just to read and understand it. Sure, I read the executive summary and made notes. You should, too. Then I read a half dozen sections, and I looked around for stuff that's good for our audience, and forget about the recommendations for policymakers. Most of us are not policymakers. But then I have to confess, I used Perplexity to summarize the report and maybe suggest a few questions, and one of those questions made it into that interview you just heard. See if you can figure out which one. Maybe experts meeting at COP30 in Brazil will use this report to help make policy. It would be great if COP and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change take off their blinders and include tipping points in everything. I don't plan to give the COP much coverage. 30 big climate meetings so far since 1990, and emissions are just growing. The rest is noise. Maybe tipping points will penetrate deeper into public consciousness. That will depress some people. But the only real road to public mental health is living in reality. Perhaps with every climate or weather-related story, media could start to include something like, of course, this does not include the growing risks of passing tipping points that threaten civilization. We can dream. The alternative is an economic circus wobbling through a series of disasters until a kind of climate earthquake strikes. Even then, it won't be a single-year event where the Amazon dies or the UK and Ireland freeze over. It is instead the opening of a time when a new system arrives, and it is not stoppable. Sadly, physically and economically, humans evolved with the old climate. So did all our animal friends and the plants we depend on. Maybe insects produce fast enough, and they could evolve to meet the heat. We, on the other hand, have to fight off this deadly hot future with everything we've got. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock.
Too hot. Way too hot. Crops dying. People dying. Cool it down. Whatever it takes, they said, turn down the sun. Cool it down. Never mind tomorrow. Gotta cool it down. Today, the climate engineers study the last days, engaging our fears of changing our ways. They said we can't make the cut. Turn down the sun no matter what. Fix it.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Warming is accelerating along with increasing disasters. Can technology turn down the heat? Can climate change be reversed? The new book, The Long Heat, delves into carbon capture schemes and into minds unable to steer away from catastrophe. The book is from Radio EcoShock guest Wim Carton and well-known European human ecologist Andreas Malm. Both work at Lund University in Sweden. Andreas Malm authored more than 10 books, including Fossil Capital, The Rise of Steam Power and the Roots of Global Warming, and Overshoot, How the World Surrendered to Climate Breakdown. Let's talk about The Long Heat. From Sweden, Andreas Malm, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's a pleasure and honor to be with you.
Why did you and Wim call your book The Long Heat?
Because this heat is going to stay with us for a very long time, it seems. And we're trying to map the front lines of climate landscape that we think will be in place for the foreseeable future. That is, we will have too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, so we will have very high temperatures, rising temperatures on Earth, and then the question is, how do we deal with this? And that's what we're trying to explore in this book.
Some Greens reject any form of geoengineering as unnatural and doomed because of our record of making things worse. Do you think that that is a mistake? Should progressives hold out hope for technical help in this damaged atmosphere?
I think it's very important to be precise and concrete and not sweeping about these things. So there is no one position that can cover all technologies, but rather you have to study each and one of them and examine their merits. And I don't think we can reject solar geoengineering, if that's what you're referring to, out of a general opposition to technology as such. But I think that if you investigate this particular technological proposal, or proposed technology rather, you will conclude, or at least that's the conclusion that I would make, together with Wim, that this is a very bad idea indeed. Then there are certain technologies for carbon dioxide removal that might have some potential. We are in such dire straits that we cannot just write off all technological solutions a priori as, you know, by definition, flawed. We have to be very careful about this. That said, we argue very forcefully in the book that there's no way that we can get the climate crisis under any kind of minimal control without shutting down the fossil fuel industry and leaving fossil fuels in the ground. This is the alpha and omega. But because we have waited with doing this so long, we might also possibly have to use certain technologies for drawing down CO2 from the atmosphere.
So it's hard to picture just where we are on this climate escalator, I would call it. The German Meteorological Society and Stefan Rahmstorf accepted 1.5 degrees C is behind us, or at least no longer possible. But some American scientists are more conservative. They want to stick with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change projections. Where are you on the 1.5 debate, and where are we in climate change?
I think we're flying past the 1.5 degree threshold very fast, faster than most scientists had expected. Last year was the first year when average temperatures on this planet were in excess of 1.5 degrees in comparison to the pre-industrial baseline. And I don't think it makes any sense to wait for two decades before concluding that this threshold has been passed. You know, there's this notion that the average has to exceed 1.5 degrees for about 20 years before you conclude that we've actually crossed this threshold. But the warming is now so fast that we might very well cross 2 degrees threshold too within 20 years. So that would mean that, you know, we would never have crossed the 1.5 degrees if we have to wait for 20 years until we can conclude that we have done so, which makes no sense now that the warming is so fast. So I think, yes, I think Rahmstorf is right in the sense that 1.5 degrees is now being breached, The question is, can we limit that breach so dramatically that we can retain a capacity to go back below 1.5? This is now the big question. And of course, the next limit that appears in view is 1.7 degrees and then 2 degrees. And the faster this goes and the higher the temperatures, of course, the greater the necessity of slamming a brake and shutting down the fossil fuel industry. This doesn't mean that the struggle is over, but it means that we have crossed the first extremely crucial line and missed the target of keeping capping global warming at 1.5 degrees. So this just increases the urgency, of course, of mitigation of climate action.
You know, I'm beginning to have less patience for the idea of transition, where we have a whole plan that's going to take 20 years, and meanwhile these disasters are becoming unbearable. So I'm wondering, is it too late really for transition? What we should be doing is going for a shutdown, going for a World War I, World War II kind of everyone together, let's change this whole system.
Yeah, well, this war analogy is a pretty old one in debates around transition. These analogies have been around for a long time, and people have imagined that once we, you know, hit the kind of crunch moment, something like a wartime mobilization will have to happen, and that this is what the transition would look like, where the state takes very strong command over the economy and shuts down the fossil fuel industry and the emission sources and shift the economy to another base. I still see that as a scenario, but it's evidently purely hypothetical and doesn't conform to any of the actual political trends that we're seeing in the key territories of the fossil economy in the global north. I mean, the US is going in exactly the opposite direction, and very much of the EU too. Where you can see, transitional trajectories are to some extent in Asia. The only country, I think, in the world that is engaging in an active transition, as in actually closing down fossil fuels and ramping up renewable energy production instead, is Colombia. That's the only fossil fuel producing country that has a government determined to phase out fossil fuel extraction from its economy. Although that government might come to an end next year when they have new elections in Colombia. But other than that, very isolated case, we are extremely far from anything like a transitional program or a wartime mobilization, which doesn't mean, of course, that these things become any less necessary, but they seem perhaps even less close to realization than what they did 10 or 20 years ago, even though the urgency, of course, in the system is much larger now.
So in our technical fallback category, for a while there was some press and scientific support for marine cloud brightening as the solution to reduce overheating. Robot sailboats would shoot up salt or something. What happened to that?
Well, there are these moments of hype around different technologies. In the field of carbon dioxide removal, there was iron fertilization in the oceans for a while, and then that went completely bust. In solid geoengineering, yes, marine cloud brightening has had some kind of hype around it or buzz for a time. There have been limited experiments outside of Australia on the Great Barrier Reef. There was an experiment that was underway in the US, but it was stopped. But in the Department of Geoengineering, as distinct from carbon dioxide removal, it really is solar geoengineering, so sulfate aerosol injection, that is totally dominating the agenda, not marine cloud brightening as far as I can tell.
So we would reduce the amount of sunlight reaching the surface of the Earth. That might just affect our solar power, which is supposed to be the way out of a lot of this, and also our farm crops, which we need for a few billion people. I just don't see how anyone can argue that it'll be all right to reduce the amount of sunshine getting down here.
No, but the argument is made from a position of despair and desperation, if you will, where the argument is that, okay, it's too late, the heat is too high, and there's only one technology that we know of that has the capacity to slash temperatures to stop the process of heating and potentially even reverse it virtually from 1 year to the next or even 1 month to the next. And that technology is sulfate aerosol injection. So you take airplanes and you send them out into the stratosphere and you shoot out soot to create a kind of a parasol or an umbrella or a shield around the sun that intercepts some of the incoming sunlight, block it, and thereby cool the earth. And I mean, that in and of itself is a pretty straightforward and strong case. What the advocates of geoengineering tone down are the enormous risks with the byproducts and with the side effects that keep being simulated and mapped by scientists in this field. It's very likely that geoengineering would wreak havoc in the climate system, some havoc that can be predicted, some that cannot, and that the end result would be various kinds of secondary and tertiary chaos in the climate system, including some of the side effects that you mentioned. So the case for geoengineering rests on the argument that when the climate crisis really explodes in our faces, which it is, you know, bound to do if we keep on treating it the way we do now, then we have to, there's only geoengineering that would allow us to manage it in the short term. You know, this case is strong, as I said, and there is an inbuilt logic here that makes it quite likely that at some point someone will try to do geoengineering, precisely for the reason that it's the only technology that has that capacity. But if someone tries to do it and deploys these planes, it's also extremely likely that you will see a whole series of side effects, you know, explosions, if you like, going off in the climate system in all sorts of places, and that it will not turn out anywhere near as well and orderly as the advocates of geoengineering imagine.
And there are a number of dead ends in geoengineering, like proposals to refreeze Arctic ice. Some of this stuff gets almost comical, Andreas, if we were not in such dire straits. Can you tell us about a dubious scheme that you cover in the book?
Yeah, there are many. You know, in the Department of Solar Geoengineering, you have utterly cranky, crazy ideas such as hitching the Earth to an asteroid and nudge it out of orbit away from the sun to reduce temperatures. This is not something that many have taken seriously, but there, you know, there's a whole spectrum of ideas covering the Sahara with plastic to reflect sunlight, placing objects somewhere between the Earth and the sun as a kind of a shade. Or in the field of carbon dioxide removal, you have similar far-out ideas, such as the idea that we describe in the book to hang lamps on the rainforests. The argument here, this was in a paper written by a couple of climate scientists the other year, the idea is that photosynthesis is naturally limited by nightfall. You don't have any photosynthetic production happening when it is dark. So if you produce artificial light, you can keep photosynthetic productivity happening around the clock, and this will draw down more carbon. So imagine illuminating the Amazon, for instance, during the whole night, and you would, according to these scientists' models, simulations, you would massively increase the drawdown of CO2 into the plants of that rainforest. The only problem then, of course, is that the entire rainforest and everything that lives in it is completely adapted to a diurnal cycle. So towards the end of that paper, these scientists would allude to the possibility that the entire ecosystem might come crashing down when all organisms are deprived of nightfall. Yeah, there is an idea that to speed up enhanced weathering, you can blow up the seabed with nuclear bombs to produce more surface for the weathering process. You know, everything. There's no shortage of imagination about when it comes to how to technologically interfere with the climate system. But virtually all of these schemes come with extreme hazards.
So you block the sun with your planes and my monsoons stop coming, so I shoot your planes down. Experts even study counter-geoengineering, like wars in the stratosphere. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the case that you bring up here is one well-known potential side effect that sulfur aerosol injection might disrupt weather systems, including the monsoon on the Indian subcontinent that might collapse completely, and indeed, according to most model runs, will do so under any reasonable scenario of solar geoengineering. And then you have the scenario where the victims of such a side effect would have a strong material interest in stopping the solar geoengineering, so they could either attack the infrastructure or they could try to overtop the effect of solar geoengineering by, you know, maliciously releasing a lot of greenhouse gases to get the heat up again, or in some other way try to sabotage the ongoing process. So then there are all these speculations about what could happen then and what kind of conflicts could escalate and spiral in what direction. And one conclusion from this literature is that solar geoengineering is not going to work unless you have one power that wields some kind of monopoly on stratospheric violence or coercion, if you like. That is, there has to be one centralized sovereign ruler to avoid total chaos, someone who can stop counter-geoengineering and keep these conflicts under control, which is a scenario that lends itself towards quite authoritarian planetary structures, as many have pointed out.
Well, I would like to be the ruler of the stratosphere, but perhaps we can have an election for it.
Yeah, there have been people who have imagined that you could have indeed some kind of a democratic structure for governing geoengineering, or that you could do it through the UN, or that the IPCC could do something like this. There is a remarkable degree in this, in the pro-geoengineering literature, a remarkable degree of optimism about rational, peaceful, cooperative behavior in the governance of geoengineering. But this doesn't really seem to be the world that we're living in, and it also doesn't more particularly seem to be the world that has pushed us towards even considering this option. The world we're living in is the world of Donald Trump, and the world of his rivals, the Russian and the Chinese states, with their own authoritarian leaders. This is the actually existing world. So what you would need to imagine here is the weapon of geoengineering falling into the hands of someone like Donald Trump, and it's very likely that it's going to be the U.S. that does geoengineering, if anyone ever does it, for some obvious reasons. And will someone like Donald Trump, or whatever president succeeds him, in the trajectory that American politics is in, would someone like him deal in a rational and peaceful and generally cooperative fashion when doing geoengineering? I doubt it.
So you and Wim, in the book The Long Heat, you ask a question in the preface that still bothers me. And the question is, can we live with the crisis that was not stopped? What do you think? Can we?
I don't think we can have a straightforward answer to that question, because we don't know what the future holds. It's impossible to predict, and we're not in the business here in this book of giving simple answers to these questions. It's definitely too early, and in a way also too late, to just call it a day and say that we're doomed and we are staring at an inevitable apocalypse and we just need to learn to die. That's definitely not our position. But we also need a lucid realization of just how bad the situation is and how many uphill battles will need to be waged in the near future if we're going to save this planet in a livable state. And of course, all of this playing out in what I think clearly is a political climate that is degenerating incredibly fast, undergoing fascization, producing genocide, and veering towards ever more aggressive far-right politics in the Europe and the US, at least. And this is not conducive to climate action. To the contrary, it takes us ever farther away from it. So to make any progress here, we need to turn around some very major political trends, and that's not going to be easy.
I find it interesting. We've been talking about politics and not the great shadows in the room, capital, the giant mega corporations and the billionaires who are making more and more power for themselves with less public view on it. Do you think we need an economic meltdown to save the natural world?
Well, I don't think there is any automaticity in the arrival of an economic meltdown or crash producing good effects for nature or, for that matter, working people around the world. I mean, if you look at the history of capitalism, most crises have rather been used by the capitalist class to unleash new waves of aggression against both nature and working people. So it depends entirely on how an economic crisis is dealt with politically. And if there is a new economic meltdown of the kind that we experienced, what is it now, almost 20 years ago in 2008, the outcomes for the climate, for the planet, for people at the bottom of the pyramid, the base of the pyramid, are totally determined by how a crisis is dealt with politically. And again, unfortunately, very often it's ruling class interests and nationalist politics that tend to capture the moment of economic crisis and take us even further away from progressive politics. So I don't think we can, you know, sit back and just hope that there was going to be an economic meltdown, because it's not on its own going to save us and might not even make things easier for us.
And yet the hope for natural disasters being some persuasion that would change the whole masses of humanity towards climate action, that doesn't seem to happen. We just get knocked over and then we suffer and then we go on again.
Yeah, and what's important to keep in mind here is that the bulk of the climate suffering that is happening in the world is happening far from the centers of capital accumulation in the global south, in countries like Pakistan and Iran most recently. Pakistan perhaps most notably with the mass displacements that happened in Punjab a couple of months ago, more than 2 million people displaced by another season of extreme floods. This is one of the most vulnerable countries in the world. But it passes, you know, almost without notice, because our media is just so habituated to the destruction of the lives of brown and black people in the peripheries of this capitalist world order that no one raises an eyebrow in the core, in the center, when these kind of things happen. So the worst climate disasters strike the people that have done the least to cause it, such as very poor peasants in Pakistani Punjab. There's no like recursive process where that translates into progress on climate mitigation in the rich countries. And when you have climate disasters in rich countries, such as the fires in Los Angeles in January, there is, no suggestion there is some kind of causation or link between these disasters and sudden epiphany or cathartic insight about the state of the world and the idea that, okay, now we really have to do something about this. That's not what happened in the U.S. after the fires in Los Angeles. And there always seems to be a pattern where the far right that denies the climate crisis is getting stronger every year in the U.S. and in Europe, and the actual experiences of climate disasters do not seem to be able to slow down, let alone stop this trend, maybe even to the contrary.
Well, we can't let that go without a mention of your book, White Skin, Black Fuel, on the danger of fossil fascism. You suggest the rise of the far right can be understood as a reaction to the climate crisis, and that was in 2021. It seems almost prophetic now. Are you still thinking about all that?
Yeah, I am, but I'm not working on it myself. I'm working on a nerdy historical project that takes me deep down into history. But my comrades in the Sentkin Collective are actively working on this, and they are preparing a second book that is forthcoming from Verso called The Great Driving Right Show, which focuses on the role of the car in far-right politics. and how the far right opposes any kind of climate action by posing as the defender of the car.
I just spoke to a scientist about 4.5 million years of history of sea level rise, and he was looking for a mirror in the past that would show us something about our future. Can we say that's part of your new project?
Yeah, well, kind of history research, I think, should be related to present concerns. So when I'm writing, as I'm doing right now, environmental history of the early Middle Ages, I'm, of course, trying to see what is relevant there for what we are interested in now. That's how the most, I think, illuminating historical research works, which is not to say that there are any immediate lessons from what happened in, for instance, the 8th century in Europe to our situation now. It's not as direct as that. The strategic discussions about what needs to be done now will need to be much more, you know, focused on the current balance of forces in the world and the conjuncture we're facing.
From Sweden, we've been speaking with author and intellectual Andreas Malm about his new book with Wim Carton, The Long Heat, Climate Politics When It's Too Late. That's just out from Verso Books. You can find links to follow this whole discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andreas, thank you for sharing time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you so much.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Just for depressing fun, you may want to follow Professor Elliot Jacobson on Blue Sky. He's a retired professor of mathematics and computer science. Elliot's been a casino consultant and wrote 3 books on casino games. Now he posts about the odds of compounding climate disasters, and he calls that the climate casino. He does not like our odds. Elliot is an unapologetic doomer. Last week, he reposted a global heat map generated through the U.S. NOAA service. The main site there says it is closed and will not be updated, but some of the data machinery and maps are still operating if you know where to find them. This latest map shows Earth is 1.9 degrees C hotter than the 1850 to 1900 IPCC pre-industrial baseline. It is already close to the much-feared 2-degree limit agreed to in Paris in 2015. Of course, that is just for one day, October 25th. There's a huge smear of red heat over many continents on this Earth, from Australia to the Arctic. That is how it starts. A few days here and there, over 2, and then a week, and then a few years. 2024 was the first full year over 1.5 degrees C of warming. If we get a few years in a row, we are there, already in the danger zone. Find a link to Elliot Jacobson in my show blog. New Science finds extreme weather and climate extremes are increasing in the Arctic. We just saw that when the remains of Typhoon Halong swept into western Alaska on October 12, 2025. The storm surge flooded villages 60 miles up the river. Some people were washed away in their homes. Giant Air Force jets airlifted survivors to safety. All this year and last, strange atmospheric rivers have traveled to the Arctic, where they were seldom seen, and they have been seen now deep in Antarctica. Just in case anybody wants to know. We are out of time for this week. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Oh, the thunder, rain that will stop, city streets drowning, power is down.
But
why is this happening now? Never before. Why is the sky and river rising water in the dark, all on time?
the bay.